welcome to Who Corner to Corner podcast. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Jeff, and I'm joined, as always, by my other host, whose name is...
Paul. Yes, that's me. Well done. Hello.
On cue. Well done.
Yeah, it's only taken us 2 years to get this. So slick.
God, the edits to make that work are painful for me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we're joined by a guest today who's a gentleman whose contribution and involvement to the world of Doctor Who has been long and expansive and has touched many aspects of the things that we've seen and watched and read and enjoyed over the years. And today we're going to find out a little bit more about him and his involvement. So I'd like to say hello to Mr. Edward Russell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. How are
you
today?
Welcome. It's good to see you.
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. I'm enjoying some time off work at the moment, which as a freelancer is kind of happens every now and then. You're sort of half scared, but also enjoying the time off, so... It's great.
Yeah, we can relate to that. Yeah, we're both in that position, aren't we?
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Good.
So, Edward, you've got a very long history with Doctor Who, as we just mentioned. But for anyone who doesn't know you and what you do, why don't you give us a potted history of yourself?
I mean, in terms of my work on Doctor Who, I started on Doctor Who with David Tennant's second series. Yeah. And basically I was brought on board that first series with Christopher Eccleston, as you know, was a huge success. Mm. And there'd been some activity around it. I don't want to just say merchandise because that restricts it to just the commercial side of it.
Yeah.
There's all the other stuff, all the BBC stuff, all the public service stuff as well, was really, you know, hotting up, etc. And there were lots of stakeholders wanting to sort of have access to the production team. And so I was brought on board to join someone else who was already there to sort of be the link, as it were, between, if you want to call it, Russell, Julie and Phil, who were running the show at the time, and then all the other people around them, sort of like a buffer, a barrier, etc. I think my job title at the time was brand executive or something like that, but I eventually became known as brand manager. So I did that for, how many years? Was it about 12 years, 14 years? I did it until 2017, so yeah, that's 14 years. And basically, the job evolved. I became the brand manager, and basically what you are there is the bit like I was explaining, but you're kind of like a conductor of an orchestra, so you've got all the bits doing all the different areas, the magazines, the books, the toys, then all the public service stuff like the website, the proms, all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, wider and things like marketing and press and photos, and even sales of the show abroad. All those are done by various people, but you need that one person to sort of be the conductor that sort of brings them all together and brings them all in time and makes sure that they're all operating in the same way. Because if you think about it, a PR part of the BBC is also doing PR for all the other dramas and all, you know, EastEnders, everything else. So you need someone who's giving the Doctor Who perspective. So that was my job, and I did that, as I said, from the start of David Tennant's era right to the end of Peter Capaldi's era. So that saw me off at the end of 2017. I did do a lot of conventions after that. I sort of made the most of that and sort of flew around the world, or was flown around the world for a bit. And then I think with the combination of wanting to move on a bit and COVID, I sort of stepped away from Doctor Who a little bit. To be honest with you, you're kind of my first foray back into the world of Doctor Who, other than as a viewer now.
Ah.
So, so, yes.
We are delighted and honoured to have you jump back in with us.
Oh, I'm sure it will. So, Edward, we'll come back to your work shortly. I was going to say, you make it, I think you've downplayed it all a little bit there, and your involvement with everything, you've made it sound, you know, quite casual, you know, I was do this and, you know, but your involvement was, you know, gigantic really. And I will find out more about it, but the, like you said, being that conductor and fielding all of that stuff and all the things you've been involved in is quite staggering really, you know, to think about it. So, looking forward to finding a bit more about it all.
I suppose I'm slightly deliberately downplaying it because, you know, the people that did those things are the people who should get all the glory. And I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to sort of say, oh, no, it was all me. Even though there probably are lots of things that, you know, I had a direct influence on, including there's one very significant thing, which I'm sure we'll come to, that I had a direct influence on the show itself. But you know, I think it depends really. If you're a really hardcore fan, perhaps like I was growing up, who cared about certain things, then I'm pretty sure that I would have had quite a major influence on something that you've enjoyed over the last 20 or so years of Doctor
Yes,
Who.
So I think so. Yeah, definitely. You know, we know your name, and you know, you're quite well known within the world, I think, for, you know, for everything you've done. So that's it's almost like we scripted this bit, because my next question is, tell us how you discovered Doctor Who as and became a fan.
Well, as you get older, your early memories disappear a bit, don't you? So it's almost my earliest memory now. I'm sure if you'd asked me...
Oh, mine are totally gone, yeah.
If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I would have had another early memory, but I've got a very strong recollection of watching Planet of the Spiders, obviously John Pertwee's last story. And and I'm not sure that was my first Doctor Who, because there's been moments over the years where I've perhaps watched other John Pertwee stories, and there's been something very familiar about them. And of course, you know, growing up as a fan, you see pictures and stuff like that. But I definitely feel I might have seen it earlier than that. But that's the first time I was really like, oh, this is great. And I think I loved it because there were people appearing and disappearing. There were sort of, you know, alien worlds and all that kind of stuff. I loved Sarah Jane. I loved the character of Tommy, which I really identified with as well. And then you know, this character, the Doctor, suddenly changed as well. And I can definitely remember conversations with my mum or my dad, I can't remember which one, who said, oh yeah, there's been lots of Doctors before, you know, this isn't the, you know, this isn't the first one. And so for me, I would have been about four at the time. That's quite switched on of me to have already understood that this was a TV program, etc. I must have been quite bright about it, stuff like that. I don't know. But so and you'll know this, I'm sure, perhaps it happened to you, but as soon as I was hooked, I was fully hooked. And within a couple of years, I was watching it religiously, and I stuck with it then. You know, even my teenage years coincided with the sort of perhaps lapse during the 80s where the show was not as popular as it could be. I think we've all reevaluated those eras, or that era. But certainly, you know, I was 16 at the time that Child of the Time Lord was going out. So at the point where I was probably embarrassed to mention to friends that I watched Doctor Who, Doctor Who wasn't something you want to mention that you watched anyway.
It wasn't, was it? Yeah,
no,
I remember.
And, you know, anybody a bit younger or who didn't live through that period going, oh, what's he talking about? That's a great period of Doctor Who. I mean, we can look back and we can see that now that it's got a lot going for it. But at the time, just because of everything else that was going on, it was kind of uncool. So I sort of stood away from it. And then, you know, the show ended. But I got to know other people who were fans and started to have a lot of nostalgia for the older periods. I'd carried on buying Doctor Who magazine throughout all this time. Of course, the TV movie came in the mid-90s. I was 26, and so there was a bit of a, you know, feel for it again. And by the end of the 90s, I was quite part of a friendship group until the early 2000s, which included people like Gary Gillett and Clayton Hickman, and people go into the tavern. So although I wasn't massively involved in Doctor Who or hardcore Doctor, I wasn't at all involved in Doctor Who or a hardcore Doctor Who fan like these people, I was part of on the periphery of that network.
Yeah.
So I've kind of been across fandom in various ways for a very long time. But, you know, ultimately it's that thing that I'm sure a lot of people can identify with. It was a thing that I was obsessed with in childhood. And not just the program itself, sort of how it was made as well, but everything around it. And that's probably formed who I am as well today. I've just realised I've talked non-stop and not let you have a word in edgeways.
No, it's fine. We're just listening. It's always interesting finding out how people discovered the show and, you know, their history and their journey with it and stuff. So that's brilliant. So have you got a favourite episode that you go back to, you know, a comfort one that you could recite line for line?
Interesting. I mean, if we're going to talk about what we call the classic era, as it were, I mean, it would definitely be that first couple of series of Tom Baker, because that's the point where I really sort of loved it. And, you know, I mean, anything from Tom's first three series would be perfect. But I think I've got a particular fondness for Ark in Space, Terror of the Zygons, Reign of Morbius, and Talons Wang Chang and Robots of Death as well. I just think they are absolute perfection. I'm kind of aware of how such a great story as Talons of Wayne Chang has recently become less than appropriate to watch, and I completely get that. And it's kind of so it's a bit like loving songs by Phil Spector or songs by the Smiths. You have to put that in a box and go, I'm going to love that for what that is, and you know, and but respect that box that it's in. So, but yeah,
it's a product of its time.
Yeah, definitely.
So, tell us a little bit about your career path and career that you had, you know, when you started working, and how it led you to Doctor Who.
Well, kind of lucky, really. I'm somebody who, how can I put this without? I'm not particularly well educated. I left school at 16 because that's kind of what was expected of me, and I didn't go to university. But I'm slightly annoyed by that because I'm probably quite bright. So it's a bit of a shame that I wasn't encouraged to do something a bit more in my life. I think that's a generational thing. And so I sort of just went off and worked for an insurance company and did what was expected of me. But there was a part of me, certainly by the mid-20s, that wanted to follow the sort of desire I had to work in entertainment. I ended up working for a record company in London, which was great. And that was in the heart of... or during the heat, rather, of Britpop. So I was a record label that included people like Charlatans, was associated with people like Saint Etienne and all those kind of bands. And the Prodigy as well. So that was really, really good fun to be part of that.
Yeah.
And then to cut a long story short, although Madonna features, and I'm sure we'll come back to her at some point because she still features at various points of my life, I ended up working for Top of the Pops. Is the year 2000, yes. And this is the first time that having, you know, I was like, this is something I grew up with that I loved. And what I was working on was the website. And this is back in the times when websites were really a fundamental part of the thing. And, you know, they would have things on the show like, right, go and vote for your favorite song on our website, that kind of stuff. It kind of didn't work at the time because people often would have to go to another room to do that. Now, of course, we've all got our phones in front of us.
It's very good.
But we built up the Top of the Pops website and the Top of the Pops 2 website, and they were kind of became music magazines, a bit like the Top of the Pops magazine, which was really big as well. And we sort of looked at things like Smash Hits as our goal of what we wanted to achieve. We had interviews.
Gosh, I remember that.
Used to buy Smash Hits every Thursday.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we set up, I was producer of the Top of the Pops 2 website. I was assistant producer on the main one. No, I was producer on the other one. But eventually I produced sort of Top of the Pops 2 website, and I got to interview people like Bucks Fizz and Human League and all that kind of stuff. So I was in my early 30s at the time, and that was an awful lot of fun. But I was also working in the environment where the other websites were being made, such as EastEnders as well, and also the Cult website. And you'll be aware, I'm sure, of James Goss, a very familiar name to Doctor Who fans, who was running that. And so I was very connected to him, and obviously I still have that friendship base, as I mentioned, with people like Clayton and Gary. Yeah. So I was kind of in the world, and I did get a sort of inkling that Doctor Who was coming back. I remember it was at Gary Russell's party, would have been his 40th
party. Oh, really?
People saying, oh, yeah, it's definitely coming back. It is really coming back this time. I think that would have been, let me guess, October 2003 or something. And an announcement came not long afterwards. So... what happened then is the new series came out, and that was a massive success, obviously, and I absolutely loved it. And I sneaking got to see a few episodes in advance because I reviewed some for James's website.
Bonus.
And so I felt, you know, I was really part of it then. And then, you know, I kind of made a few connections, and there is an element of luck here. I got to meet a few people that were coming down from Cardiff to meet with James and chat with them and stuff like that. And once they identified that there was an opportunity for this brand executive role in Cardiff, I was invited to apply for it. And I had to go through the application process as well as
anybody else. Yeah, of course.
And it's kind of it was a new job, and nobody really knew what it was going to be. Being a fan was part of it, but being a fan is not enough. And I think this is something that I faced throughout all the time I was there, that being a fan of Doctor Who doesn't mean that you can be brand manager of Doctor Who. In some ways, it doesn't help. Because you've got to have that perspective of what the whole audience wants and what the BBC wants as well. Because you can take certain fans who just have I won't mention any names, but there's some people that you know that have no idea of quality control, who just want more Doctor Who, more of it, and they don't care what it is. They just want more. That's not
and
right
probably thing. More of a very specific type of Doctor Who as well. Yeah, exactly. The ideal absolutely, that exists in your mind. So you need that sort of detachment and professional overview that allows you to give the best product to everybody.
Yeah, you need to balance across the eras as well. So, you know, I've certainly seen collages done for designs with one Doctor, say Colin Baker, is a bit smaller than the rest of them. And I've spoken to the designer and said, I don't really like Colin's Doctor. And it's like, well, you know, Colin's Doctor is somebody's favourite Doctor.
Mm.
Colin Baker's favourite Doctor, for a start.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
I mean, we sort of set a rule quite early on that apart from the incumbent Doctor, you know, everything had to get an equal representation. Mm. So it's that kind of balance you've got to have. Being a fan is helpful, that you've got to know your green death from your seeds of death, but also having a perspective that is a bit wider as well, which I had. So yes, that was my career up until that point, up until joining Doctor Who.
Right, yeah, you're right, because and we've talked about this before, Paul. The show has to appeal to such a wide audience, isn't it? And, you know, like you say, Edward, you know, the fans want certain things, or certain fans want certain things, and others want other things. But then there's the kids who are watching it, and
for the first time.
Yeah, for the first time. Mm. And, you know, it must have been quite challenging trying to hit all of those, you know, quadrants of audience, and the same when making the show as well, you know.
And across all the different output as well, you know, all the different ranges,
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. We sort of identified that young audience as the key audience, and family audience as well. I mean, the nobody was pretending that the classic series didn't exist at all. In fact, quite early on in Russell's reboot of the series, it was quite heavily mentioned, you know, school reunion and that kind of stuff was bringing, you know, not the first time it was brought back in, but suddenly bring it back in. But you had to think about the audience now, and already I could hear, you know, you don't try not to be swayed by it, but people going, oh, it needs to be 25 minute episodes again, and four episode stories and all that kind of stuff. And, people have such a desire for nostalgia that they sometimes don't realize that the world has changed. And I mean, I'm sure you're probably Facebook on a Facebook group or some sort of social media group of a town where you grew up, or you can imagine that. And there's always like pictures of the city centre 30, 40, 50 years ago. And there's always someone that goes, oh, it was much better then. And you think, well, it was.
Of course,
you'd probably die from cancer at the age of 65. And if you're a woman, you wouldn't be paid the same. And all the, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like life wasn't better then. And life has changed. And I think the same has to be remembered for Doctor. Yeah. It's all about the future. And it's all about the current generation. Yeah. You've got to keep bringing
in. Totally agree.
You've got to keep doing that. And you shouldn't. You don't want to dismiss the older fans at all. But if you get it right for this audience, then everybody else will follow. And there'll be somebody listening to this now going, oh, they don't care about us and stuff. But, you know, we do.
We do care about it.
But I think it's really important to hold on to the now in anything you're doing, which is reaching an audience.
Yeah, I think it's so important, because if there's no audience now, like you're saying, and no new people coming in, then the show isn't going to continue. You know, you know, you've got all the old fans and, you know, people like us and stuff, but
we'll always be here. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? But we're going to dwindle as we get older.
And if you know, like you said, Edward, you've got to look to the future. And I think it's, you know, we've again talked about this, but, you know, with music and stuff and with bands, you know, people often know their first album was the best, and, you know, well, actually it's not, but you end up so nostalgic for it that you,
well, sometimes that might be, though, but that's that's sure an opinion thing, isn't it? And that's a slightly different thing, but
things have to move forward and progress and bring new people in, or else it just starts eating itself, I think, and, you know, it becomes creatively stifled, I think. So
the thing is, if you try and keep everybody happy, then you're watering down what you give to both sides of it, really. And the thing with something like Doctor Who is there is a way of super serving that hardcore fan. These Blu-ray reissues of the various series they've been doing for a few years now, 5 years or so. That's a great way of really making that
very much so
dedicated fan happy, and that doesn't really impact on somebody who's just come to the show at all. So you know, it's finding ways to do to keep that happy, keep them happy. But you're always looking for new audiences as well. I remember. So this is jumping forward a bit, but whilst it's in my memory, when we introduced the character of Bill to Peter Capaldi's Doctor, I don't know if you remember, but there was that short sketch or short mini episode where they... That was broadcast in the middle of a football match. So it was half-time, and that, was, that went in there. And I could, I remember a lot of Doctor Who fans sort of saying, this is ridiculous. They don't know their audience, as if Doctor Who fans watch football and stuff like that. And it's like, well, Doctor Who fans are going to tune in anyway. But what we are doing with this particular audience is bringing in people that wouldn't normally watch Doctor Who. And they're going to watch it and they might go, oh, this is quite good. I mean, I think on that particular match, and I can't remember the statistics, but there was quite possibly a lot, a younger black audience watching. And of course, Bill being a black actor, you wanted to sort of like show a representation of them, what something they could associate on screen. Yeah. So, so you've always got to be thinking about who you can bring on board. You've got your people who are always going to be part of it, hopefully. And just think about what other new people you can shovel along.
Well, there's always these marketing discussions, aren't there, on online, which I'm sure you've seen as well, Edward. And
you know, in which everyone's an expert, you mean?
Yeah, and the show doesn't do enough, and it isn't doing this, and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But what you've said is, you know, basically, it isn't it. You know, the Doctor Who fans, we're always going to watch. You know, we see the set reports and the leaks and all of that sort of stuff. But the casual audience who are not, you know, the hardcore obsessives like us.
Yeah,
you know, people wonder why there's not trailers on TV 3 months before the series airs, because people won't remember. So that's why it's 2 or 3 weeks before. And every year these conversations come up, don't they, Paul? And
I tend to just ignore them, Jeff, to be honest.
He ignores it,
And I always I'm good at that.
It's the same, if, you know, every year it's the same, a couple of weeks before, because that's how you get the not us audience, you know.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting is...
I'll be honest, I'm not aware of those marketing conversations. I don't follow them. I probably did at some point when I was...
Good for you.
Don't.
And I'm certainly aware of that whole kind of thing where people think, oh, they should be doing this, that, and the other. And you know, they could be right, but also at the same time, there's probably a very good reason why they're not doing that. And that's a perfect example. It's like you need to have a call to action. So whilst it could be tempting to say to people, this is coming soon, people go, oh, that'll be back soon. Unless there's actually anything for them to do, then it's kind of a waste of everybody's time. So, so once it's kind of like, you know, for example, with the song Pre-Save This Now, you're like, oh, there's something I can do. But, you know, otherwise it's kind of pointless. Mm. You guys seem very switched on.
Well, we
try to be. It's because we're advanced in years. We've been through all that kind of stuff as young things, and now we're getting a little bit, or at least I am anyway. But it kind of reminds me, just talking about this stuff here, is how right that first series at the relaunch got it. Mm. You know what I mean? Because it seemed it must have been such a risk at the time, even though it had the backing of some big names in the BBC and people seemed to be for it. Like you said at the start of this conversation, Edward, that hangover from the 80s was always at the back of everybody's minds. The fact that it wasn't well loved at that time by the general audience, and the fact that, you know, is the world ready for Doctor Who? Could Doctor Who even exist in the 21st century now? You know, well, so everything was done right and it worked.
Yeah, they got it spot on. And, you know, it's before my time, so I wasn't privy to all the conversations, but I did hear things that you know, afterwards, and I think there was a lot of research done, and some of the things that came up from that research was that people associated Doctor Who with wobbly old sets and men in rubber suits and stuff like that, and so, you know, there was a keenness quite early on to avoid anything which resembled that. Which is why,
although they did have Slitheen in rubber suits, didn't they? So,
yeah, but then
but it worked.
But you, But Slovene, see, this is where Russell is such a genius, is what Slovene does is it reverses it. It's actually a green monster in a human suit.
And yeah.
So
yeah,
you might not be thinking that through too much, but that is what happened there, and that sort of probably seeped into people's psyche in a way. I really do think that Russell is a genius in many ways. But that's an example of where he got that absolutely right. But I think, you know, there was a big fear quite early on to be very careful about stuff. So quite early on in my time, there was a restriction put on old episodes of Doctor Who, so they couldn't be shown without permission. Because what we didn't want to have, it's not that they couldn't be shown, but if a clip was going to be used, it had to be permission given first from the production team. And that was just...
Used sort of in the series, do you mean, or used...
On other things.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
So if you had, I don't know, an actor appearing on Jonathan Ross, whatever, was a big interview show at the time.
Right.
And he wants to say, well, you, of course, you used to be in Doctor Who. And perhaps it was one of those clips or it was an episode they wanted to use where it was, you know, you could see that what they were going to do is take the mick out of Doctor Who and laugh about it.
Then we'd probably say,
not sure we want you to use that clip. And so that was one of the things that was put on as a restriction quite early on. And we didn't use it. We weren't heavy-handed with it. It was just awareness. And that way we got to know as well that, I don't know, Michael Jayston is appearing on This Morning or something like that. So it was a good way to sort of find out what was happening. And I think that was a sensible move because don't assume that when Doctor Who came back, everyone started watching it. It took a little bit of a while. And there was still a lot of people that were like, oh, I don't want to watch that. That was rubbish. And we had to overcome that.
They're still carrying over that stuff, aren't they? So I guess really, you know, it does go back to that thing of protecting your brand to a degree, but ensuring the brand is maintained at a high threshold, right, in the sort of perception of your audience.
Yeah, I mean that's the ultimate thing about brand management is, essentially you want to make sure that if something's got the name Doctor Who on it, that it lives up to what the expectations of Doctor Who are, quality. Russell was busily crafting an incredible family drama that was high quality in terms of scripts, in terms of visual, audio, everything. And therefore, if you buy a Doctor Who pen, obviously it's not going to be like that, but it's going to be of good quality. It's not going to be something that the ink doesn't work or the logo rubs off, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. My hands are turning green and that's not the ink.
Exactly. Or what you could actually do, and this is something that was kind of addressed at some point by my colleagues at what was then BBC Worldwide, and I was a part of this, is you think, well, actually, if it's a Doctor Who pen, what can it do that's different? And it could be that actually, you know, invisible ink or something. That's why it's a Doctor Who pen. Because otherwise what you're doing is what's known as brand slapping, where you're just putting a logo.
Just slap a logo on something. Yeah. Mm.
So, and I did see things like that. I think I saw a Doctor Who barbecue kit at one point.
I'm going to be on eBay looking for that later.
I'll be fetching something now, won't it?
So,
actually, just on that, so you were involved in a lot of those discussions, I'm assuming then, as to where the brand was going to be applied and the licensing and stuff like that?
Sort of. It wasn't kind of my decision. So basically, now the way the BBC works is slightly different now. That's part of why my job went in, and I'm sure you're aware of this, is that in terms of the core BBC, the public service side of it, is not able to make money, but it has sold the license of its properties to the commercial side, which was BBC Worldwide, to be able to exploit it. And so I work for the public service side, and I would work alongside those commercial partners, and they would make the decisions. They would go through all the rules and regulations, they would say, we want to do this commercial thing. That would come back to the showrunners and to the BBC, the very heads of the BBC and the showrunners, who would say yes or no. And I might be involved in those chats, certainly as I became more experienced, I might be sort of like, oh, they're not going to like this, or it's going to have to be like this. But it wasn't my decision. Yeah, that would be somebody much far more senior's decision. And then we would work it and make it happen. So yeah, some decisions of things were made which I didn't approve of, I didn't like. In terms of like merchandise, there was a Doctor Who Mr. Potato Head, which I used to hate. I think it was the Matt Smith Doctor, and it was basically a Mr. Potato Head fez on it or something like that. And that to me didn't feel, that felt a bit like brand slapping. But you know, those weren't my decisions to make. It was just once a decision had been made, I had to go with it and try and see what I could do to make it as good as possible.
How does it work with, you know, licensing stuff? So does a company come to you and say, you know, we'd like to get the Doctor Who license and we want to put it on, you know, pens and, you know, whatever? Or do you approach places and say, you know, we're looking to, you know, expand the brand, you know, would you be interested in taking it on, or was it a bit of both?
I'm not really sure, because that wasn't my area. As I said, that was something that somebody else did. But my recollection is it came from elsewhere. I mean, you might want to exploit opportunities. But as a public service broadcaster, you could never go, right, where can we make money? Let's go and let's write something into the show where the Doctor's got a motorcycle, and then let's go to Suzuki and try and do Doctor Who motorcycles or anything like that. That's not allowed. As much as people moan that the BBC isn't independent, it really is. It's just that the mechanic doesn't exist to allow that to happen. And I think BBC Worldwide, as it then was, had a long list of people it was associated with licenses. And it would go through a stringent process as well. It wouldn't just license everything. Things had to be ethically made, for example, that kind
of course.
And of course, there were a lot of things in place with books and magazines already. So yes, as far as I'm aware, people would come to the BBC with an opportunity and it would be considered.
Right.
I think I remember reading an interview with Russell T. Davis at the start of that, or some point within that first series, or between the first and second, where he described how he kind of pulled everything back in and basically kind of, you know, they started everything from scratch, you know, as regards to licensing and everything from that perspective.
And I think that was a very, very sensible move to do that, to sort of, you know, ground zero, scorched earth policy, so that they could start things afresh.
That's one way of looking at it, isn't it, I suppose? But then again, you get ownership of the brand back, don't you? You know, and then it's down to you and the team and everybody else you're working with to kind of build that up and make sure you get the best figures, the best merchandise, clothing and toys, games, and everything else that kind of goes with it. But then also the website as well, which you were sort of involved in the early days of the website. Was that just the top of the pops, was it?
To an extent, yes. And I was slightly involved in the Doctor Who, you know, in terms of a practical helping build stuff.
So what was your average day like when you were working on the show, if there is such a thing?
That's a question.
I mean, there was no such thing as an average day. It was a great job, and I really enjoyed the fact that it was so varied. You'd come in and you would know what would be, you'd have ongoing projects. So a new series launch, and everything that went with that, that would be an ongoing thing that would start as soon as the series started filming, right up until it had gone out. So you'd be already talking to the people that were going to be across the photos, the PR, you'd be talking to, people about licensing opportunities, if they were already a licensee. So for example, character options, you might say, well, there's this and this character and all that kind of stuff. So there was that ongoing projects, and then there would be firefighting from day to day, where you know, a request would come in and you'd have to deal with that. So it definitely felt like it went in cycles, because almost every series of Doctor Who that I worked on had something really big to promote it with. So I started on that second series, then the third series we had Freema, the fourth series we had Catherine, and then of course the fifth series was a new Doctor, and so on and so forth. So it was always something new. So these big yearly or yearly-ish cycles of things happening, and then just lots of little opportunities that come. You'd come into the office generally. You come into the office and you'd log on to email and you'd have conversations with people. But in that day, I would get to do all sorts of things, from reading the next big finished script, to checking out the artwork on a Doctor Who magazine comic strip, popped a set to see Matt Smith or David Tennant or Peter Capaldi to ask them something, pop into post-production to make sure that they could send clips to Australia, send an email to BBC Worldwide to arrange a discussion about what was going to happen at the Doctor Who Experience, that kind of stuff. It was, there was a lot of plates that were being spun at the same time. It was great, and I really, really enjoyed it. To an extent, I miss having that kind of variety going on, you know, just so much to be involved with.
Yeah, huge amount of stuff.
How big was your team, Edward?
So I started off kind of like, there were two of us. There was my boss, Ian.
Mm.
And then we brought in other people. And I think at one point there may have been about, it was Ian, then me, then three or four people underneath me alongside me and underneath me. And then that kind of changed. And then Ian left and I was sort of at the top for a while. And then there were counterparts at BBC Worldwide. So it's kind of like, kind of the same sort of team. It's a difficult structure.
Yeah, like an extended.
But there was never just one person. There was always a handful of people or people would get involved. That was great because people had different levels of experience and also different areas of expertise. I think I was always seen as the Doctor Who expert. Pretty much, you know, at certain points, with the exception of the showrunners, people would come to me with questions because I knew so much. So that was great. I think I've forgotten it all now. No, it's all there still somewhere, isn't it?
it's not that far away that those
it's wired into your DNA.
did any of you expect the show to become as big as it did, you know, particularly from season two onwards?
Not really, but at the same time, it was kind of what we were looking for. So, season one had been a success. Season two, no one knew how it would go. Billy was the one, Rose was the one that everyone thought, oh, this is big. Let's hope the new Doctor works. Of course, what happened across that is David Tennant's star ascended hugely. And by series three and series four, Doctor Who was just absolutely everywhere. Mm. And David became so famous. None of us knew how to deal with that. We didn't know. We weren't. Yeah. Sure how to deal with that kind of fame, that level of fame for David. David didn't know. That kind of thing hadn't existed in the UK for a long time. He was of Hollywood star quality in the UK. And I would experience it when I was out and about with David, either at particular events where you would kind of expect it, but also, you know, I'd see David sort of, you know, I'd bump into him in the shops and we'd be chatting and he'd have his hat and scarf on and he would look a bit worried and it's because he didn't want people to recognise him because he would be swamped there. And the same went for Russell. Whenever we did an event and Russell came along to that, it was always a big problem sort of managing because Russell and you know, all these actors and people like Russell always want to give as much as they can to the fans, but you've kind of got to make their life livable as well. And sort of manage everything around it. So the show became so huge and no one expected it. But at the same time, that's what we were trying to do. We were always concerned that when shows like, I can't remember what it was called at the time, but the equivalent of Britain's Got Talent, when that was going out against Doctor Who in, you know, around 2007, 2008, maybe that was the show, I'm not sure. There was a lot of concern that Doctor Who would suffer. So we would do extra activity to try and push that. It was going to be off air because of Eurovision for a week, what could we do to make sure that people didn't forget about it? So
just to plug that gap.
Yeah, so we were doing that. So we weren't entirely surprised that it was a success, but I don't think... I mean, you would have heard people say this. I'm going to quibble it, make it sound similar to fame. But you've heard famous people say they've always wanted to be famous, but until it happened, they didn't know exactly what it was. Well, it was kind of like that for the show, and we were very associated with it. So to see that show become so big, and I don't think you should forget just how big it was in sort of 2008 era.
Yeah,
it was really, really enormous. It really captured the imagination of that young audience. Let's say they were 11 years old. That's an average. You know, it was fantastic to be involved in something that everyone had an opinion on. You told them you worked on Doctor Who, they have something to say, and hopefully,
they're positive. So, slightly diverting for a minute. you know, like you said, the show was absolutely massive then. Sometimes you see these pictures online of the, you know, Woolworths. If anyone listening doesn't know what Woolworths is, it was a shop where you could buy everything, and now you can't. We don't have it anymore. But the huge, you know, Who displays in Woolworths all the toys and stuff, and, you know, remote control Daleks and things. And, you know, things are obviously a bit different today. And there's always talk of, you know, that the show isn't as popular as it was and stuff like that, which I don't really believe. But what would you say, Edward, about like how the landscape has changed in things like that, and you know the way, because you don't even get it in the shops now. I go to the toy shops with my kids, and you know even the biggest things that sort of seem most popular don't have huge wall displays like that anymore, and things. It's everything seems very different now.
Yeah. I mean, I don't. You know, I'll be honest. I don't really keep up with what's happening on in terms of Doctor Who's popularity these days, simply because I'm just enjoying being a fan, particularly with these last few episodes. They've just been absolutely brilliant, and I certainly don't want to get involved in anything again. But I do feel that it is different. I think we had a bit of the way things went in terms of, let's call it, a fantasy element of show, just to sort of be a bit broad about it. We had obviously Doctor Who and a few other shows that were similar became really big, and that was a really new thing when it happened in the late noughties. It hadn't happened since Star Wars days, really. And then that sort of accelerated with things like the Marvel and the DC films, and that feels like that's kind of peaked, and there's been a bit of a pushback now. Maybe people are less interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah, agree.
So I think, and you're probably right, I haven't been in a children's shop since I was working on Doctor Who, but if that's the case, then it probably is just that, you know, that's not where the interest is at the moment. So I don't think anyone needs to worry about Doctor Who's popularity being less. It's still...
I don't think so.
And you mentioned earlier about research, you know, back in, you know, 2003 or four, whenever, of what did people think of the show, what were their memories of it and things like that. And I remember, I think it was during Capaldi's time, I got a weekly email to rate the episode and what I liked and what I didn't like and things like that. And, you know, I assume that kind of stuff goes on all the time. And, you know, there's a lot of research done into things. One of my, you know, favourite things is when, so I'm a big Avatar fan, and people say no one likes it. And I think they wouldn't have a theme park at Disney World if there was really no fans. Do you know what I mean? Research would have been done. And, you know, Disney wouldn't have got involved with Doctor Who if they didn't think there was an audience there and, you know, it had legs and all of that stuff. So I think, you know... none of this stuff is kind of done willy-nilly, is it? You know, and
no, I think
it's all
because of what happened to the show in the 80s, where it got effectively cancelled. There's a paranoia even amongst the perhaps people that weren't around then, because they're aware that Doctor Who was a series that was cancelled, and in the way that any of us who've gone through something traumatic in our lives probably have a bit of an area where we get a bit concerned and a bit touchy about, and I think Doctor Who fans are always worried about that. And I see some of the things happen with other shows. I'm also a big fan of EastEnders. I love EastEnders, I don't really venture into the world of EastEnders, but you know, by proxy, things come into my feed on social media, and they're always worried that that's going to get cancelled as well. You know, if the ratings are down by 500,000 one week, it's terrible, and this is what BBC needs to do. So I think there's you need to look at the general picture and see how it's relating to other things, and what the general feeling is. And I think, you know, there has been, perhaps from what I've observed as a very casual observer, a slightly less interest in Doctor Who over the last few years, and it's not been on air very much, so that's probably got a lot to do with it. But from what I can see now, it's very exciting, and people are extremely looking forward to this new era. I know I am. Don't worry about it being cancelled. Just enjoy it yourselves. I know that's hard to do, because when you enjoy it, share
that's,
it.
That's the thing.
But just get what you get out of it. Don't watch something worrying about what other people think about it. Try your hardest to do that. As hard as it is, just enjoy what you're enjoying. If you're not enjoying it, that's fine, but don't not enjoy it because you're worried about what other people think of it. That's my advice.
And I think you're right. You know, it's probably because the show was cancelled back in the 80s and the TV movie didn't work. So there's this probably constant worry that, you know, it's going to happen again. And, you know, people always bang on about the ratings and stuff. they're not what they were. But the world has changed again, isn't it? You know, we've got
the way we watch TV has totally changed.
The way we watch video games and, you know, 20 odd years ago nearly when the show came back, we only really had 5 channels.
Yeah.
Now look at what we've got. So, of course, things are going to be
different. Hey, when I were a lad, there were only 3 channels. What are you talking about?
And you didn't have colour, did you? You
know? Hey, and we had to move my dad into the aerial and stick it on his head so we could get a picture like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, if the TV movie hadn't bombed, I don't think the series that came afterwards would have worked because it wouldn't have happened that way. And also, I think the TV movie is great, but you can also see within the first 30 seconds why it didn't work.
Yeah,
the opening line
exactly.
is my old friends, the master, and my enemies, the Daleks, and all that kind of stuff.
I know it's pushing all the backstory into it. Short, you know,
backstory needs.
So what the hell is it?
Yeah, so
nostalgia there. Yeah,
yeah, and that's what's been learned, and that's why every few years now the series seems to reboot itself very effectively.
Which is what Doctor Who's always done, isn't it? It's what it's always been good at. It's what's always contributed towards its longevity.
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
So, Edward, tell us a little bit about working with each of the doctors that you were involved in, and you know what they were like, and maybe you could share a behind the scenes story or a secret about each of them. Or a good memory.
Keep it clean.
Like
we're not after dishing the dirt or anything like that. Well, unless you want to.
I don't have any shocking revelations. I mean, I wouldn't give any shocking revelations, but I don't think I've got any to give anyway.
Quite right.
My principal doctors I worked with were David, Matt, and then Peter. But across the way, I also got, you know, we got involved with a lot of other ones. Peter Davison did Time Crash. Colin Baker came on set during Voyage of the Damned. John Hurt, Paul McGann, etc. All those people got involved, Tom Baker. But and then, you know, I've met them, most of them, either since or during my time in a I was going to say personal capacity, but I suppose it is, as in, I'm not, you know, doing conventions and that kind of stuff. So I've kind of got an opinion on all of them. I've not met William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, and John Pertwee for obvious reasons. I've not met Joe.
Well, you can't be a real fan then, can you?
I've not met Jodie Whittaker or Christopher Eccleston. I've met Shooty in a totally different capacity. So I've kind of met a lot of them, really, but obviously I work with those three.
That's a good roll call.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it? You know, David was my first doctor, and I adored David. And, you know, I don't have to explain why, do I? I think anyone who's seen him as a doctor just knows that he's brilliant. And I think if you've seen a single interview with him, you can see what a great, great guy he is.
Yeah.
I can remember my very first time of meeting David was on set during the filming for Army of Ghosts or Doomsday. I can't remember, but somebody will know this. It's the scene where him and Jackie are in Torchwood and they've got the Magna clamps. And Jackie says something like, I could do with those for my shopping. And they're sort of crawling across the floor with Magna clamps. That was the scene I watched. It was in an Air Force hangar being filmed. And the reason I was there was because I just had the illustrations through of David Tennant's or the 10th Doctor's comic strip for Doctor Who magazine then. And so David, well, all actors have a likeness approval, so I had to show it to him to make sure he was happy. So I was waiting there, and then I was introduced to him, you know, chatted to him. He was lovely. He was really nice. And, you know, he was so excited to see that, as you can imagine. I mean, we all know that he grew up a fan. So, so that was my very first memory of David Tennant. I'll just tell you my first memories of them all. That way, that's quite...
Yeah. Go on. Yeah, go for it.
My first memory of Matt Smith was slightly turned around, really, because what happened is he'd been announced as the Doctor. When was that? Was that the beginning of 2009, I think it was, wasn't it? I think.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Let's say yes.
There was a TV special to introduce him, wasn't there?
Yes, that's right. And then he took over properly Regeneration was a year later. Anyway, and a few weeks or maybe months later, there was a bit of a change around behind the scenes, as you're aware. And of course, I work with BBC Worldwide because there's always a bit of concern from licensees, or is Doctor Who going to be very different? What's the new Doctor going to be like and stuff? David had been so popular, so there was always a meeting where licensees were brought to go and give some advice about the new series. But this time what was happening is they were given the opportunity not only to meet Stephen, who was taking over as showrunner, but to meet Matt Smith. Just a little a conference centre, sort of like, this is us and Stephen going to get going. We can have Weeping Angels, we can have new companions and all that kind of stuff. So I got to meet Matt there, but I met him beforehand. He was given my contact number at Television Centre. I had to meet him, and then we were going to wander up the road to see the colleagues at BBC Worldwide. So I remember waiting there at the reception desk and getting a text or what have you, saying, "Oh, it's me, Matt, where are you, etc." And him coming out and sort of hi, and him sort of like coming up and embracing me straight away, and then saying, "Can I get you a cup of tea?" And I was like, "Oh, yes, all right." And he went off with a cup of tea. And so I was like, This is strange.
Doctor's buying the tea.
Exactly. But that was really great. And that was a really good, because he didn't start filming then until, 6 months later. Mm. So to have had that sort of, to be in a face early on for him, I think was helpful for me, my work. Yeah. But, just creating a bond, et cetera. And, he was very excited, as you can, might imagine. We also got to do that tour of the country when his series launched, or before it launched.
Of course.
That was one of my upcoming questions, because my mum lives in Inverness.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, carry on.
So we were part of that, and I'll let you ask any questions about that when we get to it. Peter Capaldi was different yet again. So if you remember, there was that show that announced him.
Yes, indeed.
Zoe Ball was interviewing people, and then she made the announcement. Nobody knew, absolutely nobody knew. I know somebody made a slip. Was it Sam made a slip and said Peter? But that was.
Well, I thought he meant Peter Davison.
Yeah, I think he did. He did not know, and everyone says afterwards.
It was just one of those unfortunate things, wasn't it?
Yeah, and absolutely, we had Peter there under a shroud. Nobody knew. I don't know.
Which he was obviously up for.
It was such secrecy, and because of the way BBC operates, because we were saying that, we had to have people there, sort of almost legal people, making sure that nobody did know. So anyone that thinks it was all just...
Oh, my goodness.
It wasn't. I'm going a bit over top about how it was, but, this really was secret. I'd met Peter earlier that day. It was a Sunday. I'd met him in Crouch End at about 10 o'clock that morning, along with Brian Minchin, our executive producer, and we did a photo shoot with him with Rankin. I think the shot is something like that, isn't it?
He's got his hand, he's like that.
That was fantastic, because I was a big fan of Rankin's photography. So to go to his studio and meet Peter Capaldi as well, and his agent Lindy, and spend the day with him, and watching a photo shoot by one of the most famous British photographers, was really exciting. Yeah. And then we all got in a taxi and we went up to Elstree, and I don't know if we did literally put a cloak over Peter, but we were very careful. Like, the car came in and drove around the back, and he went through a side door and was kept in a room. But I hadn't known it was Peter until that morning. Yes. So if you remember, it was all very secret. And I think on the Thursday or the Friday, people started saying, "Oh, I wonder if it's Peter Capaldi." And even in our office, and I worked in the Doctor Who production office, none of us knew. I'm sure there were people in that room, but nobody talked about it. And suddenly it made sense when people said Peter Capaldi, and everyone's like, "Oh, yes. Oh, I can see that happening." And of course, people tend to rewrite history now. They're like, "Oh, everybody knew it was Peter Capaldi." They didn't, It made nobody a lot of sense when those rumours came out. So it wasn't a huge surprise on the Sunday, because the rumour mill had been turning at full speed. But it wasn't until Sunday morning. I was literally at Crouch End on the corner of the street waiting for Brian. Brian turned up and said, "It is Peter Capaldi, and you're going to meet him now." So that's how that went. So Peter was great, because I may have met him before. I think I had, possibly, when he'd worked on the show or Tortured previously. But he was, a much more famous actor than than the others had been when they were cast.
Yeah, yeah.
So to meet him was exceptional, and just to be very excited about the energy that he was going to bring to the show as well.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked all of them. I don't have a favorite, and you know, of all the other doctors I've met, they're all so different. It's, you know,
they're all very good.
Particular memories of things, and you've gone through certain things together. But yeah, I've been very fortunate to work with, you know, in my opinion, three of the best doctors.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. So you had quite a big hand in a number of the events that took place across the time you were involved, mm-hmm. didn't you? So like the proms and the symphonic spectacular events, and I don't think you went to any of these, did you, Paul? But I and like the exhibitions and stuff, and I remember you know, going to all of these. You know, there was one in London where it was around Matt's time, and the TARDIS kind of materialized behind a curtain, and you walked through it and went into the control room, and then you know, of course, the exhibition in Cardiff. I went to Cardiff once to film in Cardiff Bay, and we had to film once the sun went down, so I made sure we arrived early so I could go to the Doctor Who place, you know, and the rest of my crew were like, I don't want to do that. And I said, well, do you want to work or do you not want to work? so we did that, and I remember going to Wembley Arena for the Monsters show, you know, where you know, they came out in the audience and stuff like that, and it was opening night. Matt Smith was there. He stood up and everyone cheered him and stuff. So tell us a little bit about all of that stuff and how they came about.
Well, I've got a lot of fondness for that, actually, that whole sort of point in time, because it had happened organically. I think the first thing that happened was the Children in Need concert. Had taken place in 2006 in Wales. And what had happened is the BBC National Orchestra of Wales had possibly approached Julie Gardner, or possibly the other way around, about doing some sort of concert of Murray's music. And what's the key linchpin then there is the person that was involved is a chap called Paul Bullock, who was an exec, or is an exec producer at BBC Music, or Factual Entertainment,
right,
in Wales. And so he organised that, and Paul is a force of nature. I'm saying this partly because he still employs me from time to time on other projects. But he then helped broker a relationship. When that was successful, helped Julie broker a relationship with the Proms people. That wasn't straightforward. The Proms people didn't want to do a Doctor Who prom. They always did something like a Blue Peter prom or a children's prom, which was a vehicle for getting young people interested in classical music. And I don't think any of them quite got Doctor Who. So there was a lot of hard work done before that was even agreed. And then I was very much involved with Paul and his team in making that first prom in 2008, I think it was. And helping create that show. You know, it's hard to say what my involvement was, other than it was, you know, a lot of it. I enjoyed that enormously.
It's across the board.
Yeah, and then that developed. You know, there was another show that happened 2 years later, and then that evolved into the commercial version, which was the Symphonic Spectacular, which first of all happened in Australia. I was extremely lucky. It happened a few times that I got to go out and be the Doctor Who representative there, because obviously you're taking the Doctor Who property all the way to the other side of the world, and although by this point Paul and his team knew it well, he didn't know it well enough. And there was no way that Stephen Moffat could go out there, or whoever was working alongside him at the time could go out there. So I went, and that was great. You know, we ended up doing one at the Sydney Opera House as well. So, you know, one of my fondest memories of working on Doctor Who is pushing a Dalek onto the stage at the Sydney Opera House, which was definitely...
To me, to you, to me.
Yeah,
to you.
Exactly. Not an experience that everybody has. So that kind of grew and grew, the monsters are coming, and the other versions of it that sort of became commercial shows as well. I was involved in those to an extent, not in the same way, but probably in the same way as I was with magazines or books and that kind of stuff. And I don't want to take all ownership for this. There were other people in the team that were involved in certain areas more than me, etc. The proms itself, I think, was very much my kind of thing. So that sort of happened. then the experience was, now I was across that, but that was a colleague of mine, Beth Britton, who was much more involved in that, and Stephen Nicholas as well. They were very much the contacts that were across making sure that the assets that went between Doctor Who production and the experience knew about what was coming up, so that, because there was a few exhibitions you mentioned one in it. There was one in Earls Court, there was one in Brighton at one point, and then there was one in Cardiff in the Red Dragon Centre way before we had the Doctor Who experience. Of course, I go back. Yeah. I remember Blackpool. I went to in 1979.
Yeah, me
and
too.
Longleat. I went to, and I was at Longleat at the 20th anniversary in 1983 as well.
Oh, were you?
Yes. So I've got
hardcore.
I've got all these recollections of the various things, but the experience, I think, was particularly good. As I'm sure you witnessed, it was a really great interactive experience with lots of exciting things happening. I'm very proud of that, and the
it was brilliant.
Reasonably small involvement I had in that was just wonderful. It's a shame it's not with us any longer, but I'm sure there'll be
some much missed.
Yes.
So you mentioned just earlier about the tour that Matt and Karen went on around the country. It was bonkers, wasn't it? They were like, you know, rock stars or something.
Brilliant.
My mum lives in Inverness, which is where Karen's from, and there was a photo shoot on the side of Loch Ness, wasn't there, I think? And
ridiculously
early. So was that all done? Was it done over the course of a week or something, all of that? Or?
Yeah, that was planned with military-like precision, again, by my colleague Beth Brin, who did a fantastic job. I think it was Piers Wenger, who was the showrunner at the time, along with Stephen. So let's do something like the X Factor bus when you see it turn up in different cities. And, you know, that's where the heat's going to be. Let's do something like that. We need to do something different. Matt isn't known, Karen isn't known, and we need to sort of make sure we're reaching the core audience and sort of get in there and get the local news and bring the fans on as well, because as we know, the fans are going to talk about it, but also get some, you know, let's not just rely on the Graham Norton show or the One Show, sort of, you know, grassroots, as it were. And so that was a fantastic thing where we had a bus,
It had that great artwork on it, didn't it?
It did, yeah. So it was branded, or wrapped as it was called, with the Doctor Who artwork. And, you know, that bus travelled around. I think what happened is it went out to Northern Ireland first, ahead of us. We all flew out to Northern Ireland's Belfast, and that's where it started. And it was really interesting. In each city, the interest and Matt and Karen's star grew. So in Belfast, there was kind of a vague interest. So we did a screening, and there were fans there, and there were fans outside, and we're like, "Oh, this is great!" But as we went across the whole country, by the time we got to London at the end, you know, it felt like he was massively famous.
Word had spread. Yeah,
but yeah. So what had happened is we then got the ferry across from Ireland to, I'm not sure where we landed, but we then made our way up to Inverness, because there was a connection with Inverness, because you said as Karen. Was from there. And what I can remember, so this would have been April or very late March, is it was snowing, and it was snowing so badly we were really lucky. It was at night time we were travelling. They were closing the roads behind us. We were just luckily just slightly ahead, so that roads
got ahead of it
because it was snowing so heavily. We got to Inverness quite late. Almost felt like I had jet lag.
I know that feeling.
I mean, it's far away.
I've done that drive. It's brutal in the wrong weather.
I can remember getting to the bar and having a drink, and then everyone's like, "No, you're going to go to everyone's going to go to bed now because we've got to be up at 6 o'clock in the morning." We did that photo shoot at Loch Ness. You know, there was no jolly to this at all. It was non-stop work, and I think I can't remember if we went to Karen's school or something like that, but we sort of did something touched on her. Her upbringing, we did a screening there. And I think we then sort of did Newcastle, Gateshead, went over to Salford. And then we ended up in Northampton, which is where Matt was from, and went to his school. And that was really good. And there was a lot more press involved at this point. There's a story, isn't there? You know, he's gone back to his school. That was a lot of fun because we had his football coach there. Matt, as you may recall.
He's big on football, wasn't he?
Footballer, and so that was great to see. I think we took pictures of them together, and we sort of came round, and Cardiff was in there somewhere. Maybe we started at Cardiff, I can't remember, or entered at Cardiff. But obviously that was, it's all a bit of a blur now, and it was quite some time.
Yeah, I imagine it is, actually. Because, of course, then it was the whole 50th as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah, I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah.
The 50th celebration event was an epic, wasn't it? Well, so you were quite involved in that, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. There was a lot done for the 50th, and something that Stephen said quite early on, it's first of all, I mentioned brand slapping earlier. We're not just going to 50th slap everything. He didn't want merchandise to be sold because it suddenly had a badge on it saying 50th anniversary, which I completely get. And I think anything that, you know, things did have that badge on it if it was reissued or, you know, was from that year. But he didn't want you know, the whole Target range reissued with that on it, that kind of stuff. The other thing he said is, let's not announce what we're doing because people will only be disappointed. We can announce that we're doing 30 things and that won't be enough. So if we don't really announce things, then there's nothing for people to be disappointed by, which was a very sensible idea and probably the only way to do it. But as a result, I think there was a lot of feeling from fans that we weren't doing anything and a lot of anger. And this was a point where, you know, the online world was... or Twitter was really sort of becoming a thing because obviously forums had existed for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember there was a lot of unpleasantness, and maybe that was about the point that Stephen decided to leave Twitter, you know, and people like that. And I certainly, even you know, my reasonably anonymous capacity, although you kindly say maybe fans know who I am, sort of received a lot of very nasty things, really, really nasty, sort of personal things. You know, people that were like. I can always remember saying something about an episode that I didn't particularly like or something, an old episode that, you know, it was all right, it was quite good, but not my favourite or something like that. And then suddenly people were finding personal pictures of me and saying how awful I was and all this kind of stuff. Just really nasty stuff. What happened is when, you know, by the end of that year, and I can't remember everything we did, but obviously you had the 50th programme, you had An Adventure in Space and Time, you had the Paul McGann special, just to mention some the Night of the Doctor stuff that happened. You had the missing episodes come back, you had lots of great merchandise, you had that 50th celebration, you had the 50th prom as well. By the end of it, everyone was satisfied and everyone was thinking how brilliant the BBC had done, but it was not a very nice process to go through from certain areas of fandom along the way. But that's something I've taken with me, and you know, I've you know, it's all a learning process curve. But yeah,
but it's very sad when that sort of stuff happens, and I think people can. It's easy to kind of fire off shots and stuff at people.
Oh, especially from the comfort of your own living room where you don't have to actually look at somebody in the eye face to face and tell them stuff that you would just rattle out on your
phone. Which you'd never say, you know, face to face. And also I think people, you know, take the piss out of an actor or, you know, criticise them or whatever, but forget that they're a real person, you know, and you've sadly experienced things, and you know Stephen did, and Chris and Russell, they, you know, everyone has, and I think there's such a thing these days about, you know, negativity and criticizing stuff, and you know we're not into that at all, you know, the two of us, but
well, I'm very pleased
when it
that.
Gets personal like that, I think it you know it crosses a line, and
it does cross a line,
and it's very sad really, when you know, and I think
and it's not, you know, this isn't a Doctor Who thing, you know. This isn't a Doctor Who thing, this happens in all
it's across social media,
so I
look
think
at Star Wars and the way people have
you know, I've sort of dipped my feet into other fandoms
straight back out again.
I feel completely removed from the Doctor Who fandom now, so I don't see. I see there's a slight obsession in what Ian Levine thinks of things, and all I will say is it doesn't matter what Ian Levine thinks of things. But yeah, that's it. I don't really know what happens. It's just one of those things. But, you know, I think what we delivered in the 50th was just brilliant. And, you know, there's a...
Oh, it was, honestly, Edward, it was incredible. Absolutely amazing.
It really was. You know, it was something for everybody, wasn't it, I think?
It really was.
You had the... the showy elements, like the cast coming up and talking, and then I was there Saturday when Tom Baker was there as well, and the older doctors came out, and then Tom comes out and he's got his walking stick, and the place went mental, and he was sort of acting like, I can't be bothered with this, but you knew inside he was loving it.
He was loving it.
And he sat down and, he was marvellous. And then Danny Hargreaves blew up some Cybermen later. And,
because why not?
And then there was the sort of production inside, the sets and, yes, costume stuff and things. And I met Matt and Jenna there, and my wife and I had our photo taken with them. My wife's not really a fan of the show, but she does like Matt. And so... she came along, and actually, the fact that she had a good time.
That says something, doesn't it?
It says, and it was just a wonderful day. Mm. I'll have to share it on our Twitter and stuff later, Paul. I shot a little bit of video there and made a little, edit of it, but it was absolutely wonderful. And then afterwards, there was the screening of Day of the Doctor, and yes, somehow I missed out on getting a ticket for the evening, the screening at XL. So we went to a cinema nearby and watched it in 3D and stuff. And, so a whole day, filled with Who and fans and people in cosplay and, all of this stuff. And it was wonderful. And so was the one a couple of years later with Peter and Jenna at as yes. well. That was brilliant.
Oh, well, I'm glad.
So
I'm
what
glad
was
you
it like it. Putting all that on? It must have been absolutely...
It's been a whirlwind.
I did, thank you, yeah. Yeah, it must have been bonkers doing all of that.
Oh, gosh, yeah, it was. I think it's like anything, it's like a roller coaster and it's a long time going uphill. Then when it starts, you have to go with it. I just remember being utterly exhausted by the end of it. but very proud of it and, got to have a lot of fun as well. So that evening that you talked about when they showed the Day of the Doctor, there was a screening at the BFI on the South Bank, and I got to go and be part of that. So that was very enjoyable. So it was a lot of fun as well, but a lot of hard work. And nothing beats seeing Doctor Who fans enjoying that kind of interaction. It really is wonderful to watch, and just to see their face. You're walking along with whoever, Tom Baker or Sylvester McCoy, and you can see their eyes. They're just so excited. One of my favourite memories is going to a school with Matt Smith. I think the school had won some sort of competition, the script to screen competition stuff, and we kept a secret. They were having an assembly where they knew it was going to be talked about, and just bringing Matt Smith into that was just, fantastic.
Can you imagine that?
That's what it's all about. I don't want to overemphasize the online side of it or the sense that fans have of ownership, but it doesn't matter at all when you've got that as a payoff. It's just a wonderful thing.
And of course, for those kids, that's a lifelong memory, isn't it? They will always remember when Matt Smith joined their school assembly, and they'll tell their kids about it, their grandkids and all that sort of thing.
I always remember at the 20th anniversary at Longleat, it was a massive queue. I don't know if you remember, but it was massively oversubscribed.
Yeah.
My parents didn't come. They sort of stayed in the grounds and let me queue, etc. I don't think they knew how long it was going to be.
I thought you'd be gone for an hour or so.
Yeah. To entertain the waiting crowds, Peter Davison came past in Bessie.
Of course, yeah.
He wasn't near me, so I had to make a choice to leave the queue to go and see him. So I did. I was on my own. I was 13, and I left the queue.
Yeah.
And I went, and there was loads of kids there, and he shook their hands and stuff like that. I took a photo, and he completely ignored me. Completely, and then went off. So I had to get back in the queue, and I was like half an hour behind and stuff. I have told him about that since.
Yeah, I should hope you have.
He's deeply apologetic about it. So.
Did I? Oh, I'm so sorry. I can imagine he'd be really polite about it as well.
When we were at the 50th, we were queuing to meet Matt, and Sylvester, Peter, and Colin walked past this queue, and everyone said hello, and sort of thing. And Colin stopped, and he said to me, in that voice of his, what are you waiting here for? I said, we're just about to go in and meet Matt. I said, would you like to come with us? And he laughed, and he said, I've got to be somewhere. I think they had their talk to go to or something. So it was only a tiny little moment. I should have talked. We spoke to him a year or so.
You should have reminded him of it, Jeff. Yes. Yeah. Very remiss there.
He could have joined in the photo. But just it was so exciting seeing them walk by like that and just having that brief interaction.
It was just those little moments, isn't it? You know, meeting the doctor and to be able to be a part of making that happen, that must be really special.
Yeah, and I think it doesn't matter how old you are when something like that happens. You know, it's
quite right. Well, look at you with Jodie a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
you
know, went to the con in London and met Jodie. Because I was going to say, it was a real shame that there hasn't been any big events, you know, like, you know, the 50th or anything since. And I kind of hope they do a 60th one. But, you know, it's time and money and all of that, I guess, you know. And things are, you know, not quite the way they were back then in terms of, you know, resources and all that,
yeah,
I guess.
I mean,
but yeah,
don't rule it out. I mean, I've no inside information, but I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't something again in the future. It's really funny. You're sparking memories of that XL convention. We didn't call it a convention. I think we were avoiding that name.
Yeah, it was celebration. Yeah.
Celebration, yes. And then the one that happened 2 years later, was it? Or a year later with Peter Capaldi's doctor. Mm. One thing I really remember about that is it was the Thursday night at XL, and I think it started on the Friday. And there'd been some bomb attack in Paris. And as such, everywhere in London was on high alert. And just little things like, for example, Danny Hargreaves was going to do a controlled explosion at one point.
Oh, yeah.
So all these little things that, you know, when people ask what it was, my involvement on that kind of stuff, it could have been anything from pushing a Dalek onto stage to sort of having to deal with reorganizing a whole exhibition area because of that kind of eventuality.
Yeah.
Lots of memories. So, just talking to you, they're all sort of slowly coming back now.
Yeah. Talking about memories, what was it like going to Buckingham Palace?
Oh, I'd thought of that when you mentioned about the 50th, because I think it's kind of forgotten about. But we did take a bevy of Doctor Who people to Buckingham Palace a few days before the anniversary itself. Tom Baker was there, John Hurt was there, and a couple of writers and other people involved as well. And we met Sophie Wessex, Edward's wife. She was the royal that we met. I mean, that was great. And that required a bit of planning. We'd been backwards and forwards doing recce, etc., just working out what form it would take. And I can remember me and my colleague James sort of being, you coming through Buckingham Palace at the back entrance, as it were, or side entrance. It's not easy to get in, but then you sort of have to go to one room to another. And we were walking down this corridor, and it was the staff quarters. Yeah. And we just noticed there was a cash machine, but it was a Coutts cash machine.
did it only dispense £100 note?
Yeah, it dispensed the
diamonds.
And I just remember going popping to the loo at one point and then thinking, shall I keep some of the toilet paper so I can say I've got Buckingham Palace toilet paper? Yeah. I'd
smuggle that out.
Yes.
Take a whole roll, yeah.
Yeah. That's why they'd never let me in.
Yeah, that was great. And that was only a few months after we'd had the King, then Prince Charles, come and visit us at Rough Lock as well. So that was, you know, one of the exciting things, one of the many exciting things that happened in the 50th year. And it just showed how big Doctor Who was at that point, that, you know, that kind of thing, that kind of connection was happening. Really fantastic. So, yeah, going to Buckingham Palace was brilliant. lots of great memories.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then sort of things got a bit bigger again, after that, didn't they, with Peter and Jenna's worldwide tour? That was Brazil and Australia and New York, maybe? And...
Well, this is a sore point. No, it's not a sore point as such. What happened here is, so this was managed by what was then BBC Worldwide, which was the commercial arm. So they did all of that. Sort of. I think we did a massive screening in Cardiff, which, again, my colleague Beth organised, and I was part of that, where we sort of shut down the city centre. And then we took them up to London for another BFI screening. And that's it. They went off then. They went on planes and went around the whole world. Where it's a sore subject is I had to be the contact on the ground with the production team that did all the approvals.
Right.
So anything like photos or video interviews or anything like that had to be approved before it went out. And there was an ongoing sort of documentary being made as well, I think, for online or DVD X or something. I had to see
brushes
of this, but that meant that I had to be on the same time frame timeline as the other people. So yeah. I stayed in Cardiff, but I got jet lag because I was, something as if I was traveling around the world.
So you got all the pain, but none of the gain.
I did, yes. Yeah. So yes. So yes, and you don't have to travel to get jet lag. So
I hadn't thought about that before.
Just start your body clock to those hours, and that's it. Yeah.
So you just mentioned about doing approval and that on all the photos, and I know you were very involved with a lot of the photography for the show as well. So how does all that work? Do you do a kind of a list of the sort of poses and shots you want from cast and actors, or do you let the how much control is in there, and are there tons of photos that we have yet to see of the Doctors, or do you take the 100 that are taken, for example, and bin 90 of them and pick Tevis? So, carry on. I was going to
stop now, Jeff. Yeah, let him answer the question.
Ask the question. Don't give the answers. So what happens is, there's two types of photography, or three types really. There's what's called unit photography, which is the onset stuff of what you see in the episode, kind of like an elaborate still. Then there's the setup photography, which tends to be about against white screen, and that tends to be of characters, and I'll come a bit more to that. And then you've got what the BBC terms iconic photos, which is an icon for a particular episode or series. People misinterpret that word when they say an iconic photo and think iconic in the sense we tend to use it, but it literally means that's the symbol.
Icon in the old fashioned sense.
Exactly. Well, an example is Peter and Jenna running, isn't it, with the explosion behind them and stuff, and Bill hanging out of the TARDIS.
Yes, that was a great one, and that was kind of an echo of one of Martha and the Tenth Doctor running with an explosion. I remember that shoot particularly well because I remember we had a springboard. So they were shot against green. And we had a springboard that they had to jump on, and they weren't in camera at the same time. Lots of fun with that one. The white screen photography, the unit photography happens during, shooting. The white screen photography tends to happen whenever there's an opportunity. So there'll be a cameraman on set with lights and a white screen, and he knows that you have to do for characters for merchandise or for magazines and stuff. The Sycorax, for example, you have to have them, in every angle and doing a few poses and so on and so forth. And so that's captured. And actually, if it gets to the end of the series and they don't have enough Cybermen poses, and maybe they're missing some Sontaran ones, then there may be a separate photo shoot set up where all that stuff is wrapped up. The iconic photography, or the generic photography, as it's also known, happens to be a concept that's been approved and agreed, and then is specifically shot. Mm. That tends to have happened at the end of the series, because that's when we've got an idea what the whole series is about.
Interesting.
And my involvement in that was would vary. There was a photography manager who looked after that, and in the last few years, a wonderful lady called Christine. I worked very closely with her. I really enjoyed working with her, and she would come up with concepts, and that would go through a series of approval, and then we would shoot it. And sometimes some of the concepts were mine, which I was always very proud of when that happened. One that I particularly liked is the one with Matt Lucas and Pearl Mackey with Peter Quaddies, where the Doctor is there with the TARDIS door open, and they're in mid-space, and Nardole is holding on to him, and he's holding on to Bill, who's hanging out. That was a concept that I came up with. So I was particularly fond of that one.
It's a great image,
It's a good one, isn't it? And of course, there's lots of photos taken that don't go out there because somebody's got an eye closed, or, or is gurning, or it's just not a great picture, or it's a bit blurred, or that kind of stuff. But, actors get a say as well. They get to say, oh, I don't like that picture of me. And, and once the other actors said that But there isn't, amazing stuff that's not been seen, as far as I'm aware. It's just, maybe a slight, different version of something maybe has gone and will probably never see the light of day. But I wouldn't worry about that too much. One recollection which is something that I think fans will appreciate, is when we announced Peter Capaldi's costume for the first time, and it's that photo, I think, where he's doing something like that. He's got the hand out.
He's got his hand out.
It's the magician, the Dr. Mysterio pose or what have you. And we'd taken a lot of photos, and there was a few to choose from. That was one of them. And nobody could decide which one. And someone turned to me and said, all right, Edward, which one should we go with? And I came up with this really silly idea. The file number of that one was 1967.jpg. And I said, 1967 is the year where there are most missing episodes of Doctor Who. So let's choose that one. So that was the reason that that image with the handout it got used. I think Peter was slightly annoyed by that because he kept having to do that pose every time somebody wanted to do a picture of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe rubbed some of the magic of being the Doctor off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's a real fanish thing that happened.
Yeah.
We talked to James Pardon, photographer, a while ago. I think he did some stuff in your time on the show and a lot with Jodie. And I said, oh, there was a picture of Jodie on the cover of DWM, and it's one of my favourite shots of her. And he said, yeah, the body was mine, but the head was from another photo shoot that someone else did, and they've been comped together. And I said, really? I couldn't tell at all. It was seamless on it. So I was like, well, I like part of the photo then.
Well, there's an interesting story there. So Matt appeared on the cover of Entertainment Weekly in America. And Entertainment Weekly is a huge magazine over in the States. To get him on the cover, I think this is in 2010, possibly, was a really big deal.
It was a big deal, yeah.
And they had various options of photos to choose from, and he was holding the Sonic. But and this is difficult for us to appreciate now, but the Sonic was quite recognisably the Sonic for the British audience. We know what it is, but it didn't quite read for the overseas. They didn't. What is that? What is it going?
Okay.
And there wasn't the right version. It needed to be something that was kind of upright so you could see the Sonic with the light at the end of it. So what we did is we retook that particular part of the photo, and that's my hand. So I put on Matt's jacket and held the Sonic in various poses until we got one that they were happy, and then that was matted on to the picture of Matt. So it's one of the the biggest magazines in the world, and it's my hand has been on that.
It was your hand.
So you're part Doctor then, Doctor
by that generation cover. Yes. Yeah, and this story must have got out. This story must have got out in some way. I can't remember, but I was at a convention many years ago now. But somebody was there with that magazine and asked me to sign it, which I was very, very flattered. Maybe she was slightly famous for a little while.
Model career beckons.
That's a story, isn't it?
Yeah. So you mentioned 1967, and that's the year of most lost episodes. So you were involved in the sort of recovery of some lost episodes, weren't you, around the time of the 50th and Enemy of the World and stuff?
Well, not really involved, but, aware of it. It was all very top secret because it was all managed in a certain way. I mean, the only thing to really say about that, and the only thing I would say is all these rumours of all these episodes that came back that were then didn't come back, or that there were screenings of The Power of the Daleks and all this kind of stuff.
It's
absolute rubbish. It really is. And I have got nobody to protect by saying that. It's what we got back is what was there to come back. Mm. And, I don't care if you do manage to speak to Gareth Roberts' next door neighbour's mum who once shared a cab with Patrick Troughton. It's just not true at all. And I was aware of these things happening, but it was all very top secret at the same time. So, my involvement was minimal. But I am telling people if they don't want to believe it, they won't believe it anyway. There are no other episodes that were part of that package that didn't come back. It just didn't happen.
If there were, what benefit is there to keeping them back? I mean, there's other stuff out there in the world still somewhere. There's always a rumour about that. But if the BBC has got stuff...
I really hope
it goes out. Yeah.
I really hope something else comes back at some point. I think, the window of that happening and of it being of good quality by the time it does come back is quite small.
But, it's probably quite narrow now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. So... I was aware of various things, but also not involved because it was quite important. It was kept top secret because I think there were issues around the recovery of where these things came from.
Yeah,
there's nothing more salacious than that involved. So yeah.
In a moment, I'll ask you a bit more about your post Who work, but I just wondered if you had a personal highlight from your time on the show that you could share with us.
Oh yeah, definitely. and it's the one moment that I kind of had a tiny bit of influence on the actual show itself.
Oh yes,
and I'm sure anyone who knows me will be laughing that and saying, "Of course he brings up this story. This is the most exciting thing that ever happened in his life." But you know, I am responsible for Kylie Minogue being on Doctor Who.
Wow. Yes.
So that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Fantastic.
That is pretty cool.
That's a brilliant claim to fame right there.
Yeah, I'm the instigator. So what happened there is I'm friends with William Baker, who was at the time her stylist and close friend. We'd been at the launch of Martha's series 3, in London. And I think there was a couple of glasses of red wine and we were chatting. And one of us said, wouldn't it be funny if Kylie was on Doctor Who? And if you remember, Kylie had been very ill in the noughties. She'd had breast cancer and recovered from it at this point, and you know, was making her way back out. A few more glasses of wine later, I think we'd gone over to Russell and Julie and said, "How about Kylie's in Doctor Who?" And they said, "Well, if she wants to do it, that's fine." The next day, I got a call from Will say, "Well, I'm seeing Kylie this weekend, and you know, can you send me The Runaway Bride, which is the most recent Christmas episode then?
Yeah.
And I'll show it to her." And I kind of like the idea of Kylie Minogue coming up with her best friend on a Sunday on the sofa and watching Doctor.
Yeah.
So I did send the disc, and things cascaded from there. And Russell's talked about it in his book where they went to meet her and stuff. And talked about writing the script, so that was my little bit, and I'm pretty sure it may never have happened if I hadn't had that slightly inebriated conversation with Will. But as a consequence, I got to be on set. I was, you know, I would visit set quite often, but would very rarely always be on set. And I got to be on set most of the time that Kylie was there, because Will was her photographer, wanted a lot of assistance because he wasn't used to being on set. There was a lot of protection that needed to be done around secrecy and stuff like that. So I got to be on set most days with Kylie, and that was great because I'm a fan, and to work alongside her was great, but kind of a bit scary as well, because not scary. I didn't want to let on how much of a fan I was. I'm sure you know how it is. You want to be a bit casual.
Yeah.
When you met her, did you say, "So tell me about yourself. What do you do? Not quite. Are you new to acting?"
Not far off. And I'm sure that Will had already told her, "Oh, he's a massive fan," or what have you. I might have wanted to talk to her about a 3-inch CD single from Japan from 1994 or something. But I do remember, I can remember one or two instances where we were chatting, and you know, it's fine. There was a couple of times when we were chatting and I was like, "This is surreal." And she might have been imparting something, you know, personal to me or something. And rather than going, "Oh my God, that's amazing, Kylie, thank you for that," I would have been just sort of like, whatever.
Yeah.
Probably a bit too cool. But I'm sure she's
come
before. But that was great. And we had a, you know, great involvement with her with the episode. That was went on to be the biggest ever episode of the modern, modern times. It was also the launch of iPlayer against that. You know, a great time. I remember we then saw Kylie the following summer. It was the same day as the prom, because we'd done the prom on the Sunday, I think, or maybe it was the Saturday, and then a group of us went to see Kylie at the O2 where she was performing that night, and we watched her concert. And then when I say group of us, it was people like Russell and Julie and so on and so forth. And we went backstage, and we had to go through a series of parties before we got to Kylie's party. Then we were in this little room with Kylie in a silver dress with a disco ball, and that was the last time I saw her. I remember saying to her, "Oh, I'll see you, I'll see you," and she sort of said, "I'll see you around," as if to say, "That's it." apart from on the stage where she's been on the stage, I've not seen her since. But that was very exciting, and you know, it's brilliant. That's what really that did
cool. for
the show.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Getting her in was a big coup, wasn't it?
It was
a really big thing. Yeah.
I remember someone saying to me they'd heard a rumor that Carly was coming in, Doctor Who, and I said, "No, don't be silly. That'll never happen." And then obviously it did. So
yeah, we got you to thank for that. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So since you moved on from the show, you've been script supervisor on a number of things, haven't you, as well? So tell us a little bit about that.
I've done a few things. I sort of left, so my job came to an end because of the way that BBC Worldwide and BBC merged into BBC Studios, so I hung around a bit, that job went. So, you know, as I'm sure you're familiar with, what can happen is when you're made redundant, you can stay and do another job, or you can choose to leave and take redundancy, which I chose to do. I've been at the BBC for 17 years. So I thought it was the right time to sort of move on. Also, you don't want to, you know, I wouldn't want to do another job on Doctor Who at the time or work somewhere else and still be sort of, it's a bit like splitting up with your partner but living in the same building. It's kind of, you don't want to do that. I did a few things, and one of them was as a producer role working on a Wallace and Gromit show, sort of, device, as it were. I really enjoyed that. But I decided what I really wanted to do was make TV. That's what I hadn't done on Doctor Who, but what I was really interested in producing was where I felt I was headed. And I need more on-floor experience of what it's like. So the script supervisor role is something I trained to do. Script supervisor, a bit like brand manager, it's one of those things you always have to explain because nobody knows, but it's kind of essential. You sit with the director, you know the script fully, and it's your job to work with the director to make sure what's on page ends up in the can for everything in it. So that's all the things like the continuity. So to make sure when you go again, that, you know, they take the sip at the same time, that they've got their scarf on when they leave that scene, but you shot the other scene earlier, that kind of stuff. But also to work with the actors to make sure all the dialogue gets across. To work with the director as well to make sure that the camera angles make sense, or, you know, where it's in the script, that you're not there for performance, but if you think a certain beat isn't captured, sort of you work with the director, do you think we've got that kind of stuff, and all the logging. It's a job I really, really like because it's one of those things that's essential and it connects with all the other departments as well.
Yeah, you've got a lot of... you know, not influence as such, but you're involved in a lot of different areas.
I mean, there is an influence, and it's a bit like the role on Doctor Who, really, because you kind of connect with everybody, and it couldn't really happen. It could happen without you, but it wouldn't be as good. It'd be a lot of hard work.
Yeah, yeah. It's the sort of role where if you're not there, that's when things start to go
fall apart.
Yeah.
Definitely. I like things like that. And so I've been doing that for a few years and I've really enjoyed it. I've done a lot on Casualty, which is shot where Doctor Who was shot in Rothlock. That's kind of bread and butter. I've been doing some bigger shows. And I've also started from that, from the show I did back in the summer, I did some directing. So the second unit. So I got to, you know, when we were shooting more stuff, the director would send me off to direct that stuff. And I think I've come to the conclusion that's what I want to do next, rather than producing. Yeah, but I think directing. So that's where my head is at the moment. I want to be a director. So I'm sort of trying to get my own short film off the ground and carry on script supervising because I really like it. Really, really like it. It's a job where you get to be a bit of a pedant. You get to tell somebody they did something wrong, but in a really nice way. But yes, so that's what I do now. I do other things as well. I keep myself busy. And it's been really interesting also, you know, to really be a Doctor Who fan now in a way that I haven't been, because you know, from that first series onwards, when I was getting to see some, I mean the Christopher Eccleston series, I was getting to see some stuff in advance. You know, for a very long time, I was very much in the know of what was happening, and now I don't know anything. I sort of disconnected with the show in recent years because I've been doing other stuff, but I'm very much on board with what Russell and Bad Wolf are doing now. I've loved everything I've seen. I'm so excited for Shooty's first full series.
We're looking forward to it.
So you have no idea where that's going to go, what's going to happen outside of what we all know?
I know.
Do you have some little insight?
Even if I did know anything, I wouldn't say that I knew anything. So, no. I mean,
no, I wasn't asking that, Edward. Honestly, the thought never crossed my mind.
When we stopped recording, you...
Well, no, I don't. I mean,
I was just going to...
Because I'm part of TV crew in Wales, you hear stuff like, oh, they're shooting something this weekend, Doctor Who, that kind of stuff. So, you know, I do know little things, but not anything real.
Yeah.
I know anything really. So, yeah.
Which is quite good, though, isn't it? As a fan, that's kind of what you want. You want to get as close to that, don't you?
People say to me, "Oh, would you go back to Doctor?" And the answer is no. I mean, there isn't an opportunity anyway. Maybe it's something else. Maybe a script supervisor. I don't think I'll ever be a good enough director to do it, but maybe in some of the future. But I wouldn't go back to what I did before.
Because you've done that, right?
It's a completed journey. It's not something. I don't think I could add anything to it. So now to properly be a fan once again for the first time in a very long time is really exhilarating, and I love it. I really, really love it. It's giving me the same excitement when I was a lot younger.
Chris
said to Russell, "Don't tell me anything. I don't want to know anything. I just want to watch it." It comes out. I was going to ask when you would. Go ahead.
I did get one very lucky opportunity on the 60th anniversary that's just passed, the 23rd of November. I got to watch the 60th anniversary episode in advance because I did a screening. In one of my capacities, I look after RTS, World Television Society, here in Wales, and we did a screening of that. With Russell in attendance. So I got to watch that episode, sat next to Russell T. Davis, 2 days before everybody
else. That's pretty good.
That's cool. Nice.
That was kind of, I don't want to say healing, because there's been nothing to heal, but in terms of it was real sort of like, oh yeah, I feel back. This is it now.
That's nice.
Complete the circle kind of thing.
It is a bit like when you did a job for a long time and you've been very involved, it is a bit like a breakup with somebody, even though you've chosen to split up with them. It still feels a bit strange, but we're on.
Yeah, it's been so much a part of your life for so long to change that that relationship. Yeah, it must be odd. Yeah, I was going to ask. You did some work on Casualty. Was Pete Levy producing then?
Lovely Pete Levy. Yes, I worked with him. He was great. Really good. Yeah. Have you chatted with
him?
He's
a diamond, isn't he?
I run a little film festival as well, and he was one of the judges on last year's event for us. So he came to the awards night in December and stuff. It was brilliant. He's a really nice
top
guy.
Bloke.
He's been ages talking to my dad, actually, on the night. They're from similar areas of the world.
They were in the bar, in the corner of the bar, weren't they, for ages, just chatting away.
he's a great guy.
Very big fan of Pete. Lovely guy.
So tell us briefly about your Royal Television Society stuff there in Wales, because you're on the committee there, aren't you?
So, yeah, I chair the committee here in Wales. So basically, RTS, you might be aware of, it's a bit like BAFTA, I guess, but much more TV-focused, whereas BAFTA is film as well. It's an organisation that's been running for, 70 years, I think, over 60 years in Wales. And it's a voluntary thing, more or less voluntary, and we put on events. The events are to educate people in TV, so we get to do screenings and then have panels afterwards. So we just most recently did something for The Winter King, which is another Bad Wolf series. We put on a screening here in Cardiff. I had a panel with the cast and crew afterwards. Yes, we got to do that for Doctor Who for the 50th. I'm currently working on another screening for something that's going to come up. So this is something that I sort of do in my own time, and I really enjoy it. I love it's kind of allows me to tick the box of some of the stuff I did on Doctor Who, I guess, really, which is to connect with audiences and to put on screenings and events. So it keeps me ticking over and that kind of stuff. I enjoy that a lot. I've done it for about 4 or 5 years. I'll do it for a little bit more. We put on a bigger awards event every year. And there's one coming up in April. I think that might be it then. I think it takes up a lot of your time. As an honorary role, so you need to sort of like think about what you're going to do next. But it's something I've really, really enjoyed. Definitely.
Yeah, it's great. And you're a fellow podcaster as well, aren't you?
Yes, I am a podcaster. So back in lockdown, probably about a week into lockdown, like quite lots of other people, I thought, let's try a podcast. And it was extremely...
That's what we said, wasn't it, pretty much?
I mentioned at one point, as well as Kylie Minogue, a big fan of Madonna growing up, huge, huge fan of Madonna, to the point where, in a bit like my fandom knowledge of Doctor Who, I sort of understood everything about the recording of her music and the writing and stuff like that. So I did a podcast called Inside the Groove, which took each song and told the story of how it was made and sort of like, you know, To the point where it was quite detailed, sort of this song uses this drum machine, which was invented in 1979 and is also used on this record and that kind of stuff, and giving examples. That sounds really boring, but trying to do it in a much more interesting way. And partly because of lockdown, and partly because I think it was a bit of a niche, it became really popular. There's similar podcasts, I think, called Sonic Song Exploder and stuff like that, which do that generally, but this one was just for Madonna. And it's in well over 100 episodes, and it's coming up to a million downloads in total.
Wow.
At various points, it was in the top 10 for music podcasts.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
It was really, really popular at certain points. And I also then turned it into a live experience. So we had a few live events. We had about 4 or 5 in London where we've gathered fans together, done a live episode on stage. So I kind of got to do that. Which was great. I really enjoyed it. Kind of happened by accident, but it made me a bit of money, as I'm sure sometimes podcasts can. It would also allow me to connect with various people, which is great. And I'm told that Madonna is aware of it. I know she's aware of it. And when I said, does she like it? The person that told me, they said, well, you haven't been closed down. So that's as far as you're going to get with it.
That's a good thing. That's a good sign. Yeah.
Yeah. What you just said there, you know, the people we've met through doing our podcast, you know, people like yourself who've, you know, been involved in the show and other fans and things like that, it's you know, one of the best things that have come out of it.
Definitely.
It's
really, without a doubt.
You know, just brilliant, really.
I started doing it on my own, but then some other people got involved. Someone who is a photographer who could talk about the photography, and somebody who is a graphic designer could talk about that. And we've ended up becoming very close friends as well. And, you know, for nothing else, that it's been worth it for those two friendships. And actually, there's other friendships along the way that have happened.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Podcasts are great for doing that. And yeah, I don't really listen to podcasts. Yeah. I've, you know, run a very successful one, but I don't really listen to them.
I don't have time to do that sort of thing, haven't you?
That's it. When you run one, you haven't got the time.
I said I'll listen to this one. I probably won't. I can't. I won't be able to listen to myself.
we'll forgive you. Don't worry about that. That's all fine. But you know what? I mean, we were talking a little while ago about some of the negative aspects of fandom, but actually podcasting is something that tends to bring fans together, not just in the actual show itself, but I mean, certainly online, where we've got, you know, we kind of establish a really positive community of, you know, like-minded fans and people who follow what we do and who contribute stuff. And, you know, and it's really nice to see. And I don't think, you know, in a way, we wouldn't have been able to grow this show or develop that community without the power of social media. So as well as the negative stuff, there's a lot of really good positive stuff that comes out of it.
And we made it clear from the outset that, you know, we love Doctor Who and we want to
see we're not going to trash it, really. That's not our thing.
We'll never do a Who's Your Worst Doctor episode. Mm. And like Paul just said, I think the audience that we've got feel very similar. And, you know, we get... there's no sort of negativity in any of the stuff that we do. And, you know, it's opened up, you know, some wonderful doors with people from the show and,
well, I think,
and other fans and stuff. And
that's a really good mentality to have. And it's kind of something similar I do with the Madonna one, but I think there are certain people that can only accept positive and stuff. I certainly get this with Madonna. So if you want to be a bit humorous or a bit realistic about something and, you know, you might want to say, for example, the Time Lash is not really the best Doctor Who story. Or you might want to say...
would
that,
never say that. Because you know why? Because it's the best Doctor Who story.
Right, okay.
So you're wrong there, Edward, for a start, mate.
Okay, so if I might want to say that Shanghai Surprise is a terrible...
I know what you mean, though.
And then suddenly there are certain elements that say, you're a hater, you're a trasher, this is terrible. And then, I'm sure you've seen it, just say absolutely awful things about you. And I think part of being a fan is seeing the shade and the light. And I think, you know, there are bits of Doctor Who that aren't as good as others, but only by having those bits that aren't as good are the bits that are good better.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think being a fan doesn't mean you have to love everything. It doesn't mean you have to trash stuff you don't love. But I think recognizing the good and the bad is part of the fun.
Oh, absolutely. Doing it
actually.
There's a way to, you know, you can criticize without tearing stuff
and without apart. Without it getting personal as well, which again we were talking about earlier, isn't it? You know, I think, you know, when if somebody jumps on, I mean, we've had a few sort of controversial, or where we've tackled controversial subjects in Doctor Who, and we have had pylons on Twitter and stuff like that. And what tends to happen is that somebody will come and make something personal, and then suddenly get a huge reaction from, you know, our kind of more dedicated and more like-minded followers. And then it gets even more personal, and then it becomes really something which is quite nasty, and which sort of bursts the kind of safe space that we want. You're right, discussion is great, but there's an element where if somebody's attacking something in a certain way, it becomes an attack on that person because they like that episode or whatever it is, because it means something really personal to them. You know, so whether it's a time in their lives, something they were going through, and then somebody jumps in from their armchair, takes that apart, makes it personal, and then it becomes, you know, becomes quite nasty. So I think when we've tried to look at shows that we, you know, we've done these battle royales, haven't we, Jeff, where you like a show and I'm not so keen on it or whatever, but, you know, we'll have those things, but always try and just kind of measure it as well and present it as objectively as far as you can anyway, as you know, as possible.
I think you have to remember that in order to be brilliant, as Doctor Who is, whatever it does, whether it's a TV episode or whether it's a book or a piece of merchandise, it has to try different things, and not everything will work.
Yeah, exactly. Like we were saying earlier, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, people could pick apart things that we did as part of the merchandise or the branding or the marketing and say that was a terrible thing they did. Oh, how embarrassing and stuff. I'm trying to think of something now, but something that didn't work.
There's about to be something. There'd be a version of the Sonic somewhere that probably wasn't quite right.
The Mr. Potato Head or something like that.
Yeah.
There you go.
Or, you know, or something a bit bigger, something like... anyway, the thing is, if it had worked, then it would be genius. And actually, there are things that were genius. The Sideman, the helmet changer, voice changer thing, that was a massive success. The Dalek Sec one was not a success, but if it had been a success, that would be genius as well. And so you know, it's like it with a pop star with their music as well. You know, if they've got to keep trying new stuff, as we were saying earlier, keep going after the now, and not everything will stick. That one thing will still be somebody's favorite, and you've got to be respectful.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, that, you know, someone else's worst episode is someone else's favorite, and it's
exactly. Know, it's all subjective, really, isn't it? Unless there's a hard commercial line somewhere, then somebody's always going to enjoy it. They're going to love that thing. It's going to mean something to
echo what we said earlier on, I'm sure Time Lash is Colin Baker's favorite story. So there we go. So.
So, Edward, we've got a few questions from followers on Twitter to fire at you to kind of round things up for our chat. So, JTW on Twitter says, if you had to sum up Doctor Who in one image, a piece of branding or key art, or just a still frame from your time on the show, which would it be?
Oh, gosh. I can think of something, and I don't want to say it because it's a repeat, but I'll go with it because it's really powerful. And I think it's the Doctor and companion running from an explosion. We did it twice. We did it with Martha and 10th Doctor, and we did it again with Jenna and Peter Capaldi's Doctor. And it just feels you've got best friends. It's an adventure with a friend. I think that was a tagline that was used behind the scenes at one point. And they're holding hands or what have you, and they're running from something glorious and deadly and wonderful at the same time. And any image that's kind of captured up that is always something that I think really sums up my memories and also what the show can be about.
I remember both those images. They were so good. The Peter one particularly, it was so nicely done and so atmospheric, and you know, it kind of captured, you know, Jenna's got a kind of excited smile on her face, he's looking kind of mysterious, and it, you know, it's exciting and dangerous and all that. It was just great image.
Can I just add to that, actually, just on that same thing, for me the equivalent image of that would be and I wish they kind of stylize it in some way, because it's really low res because the time it was at, but is Sylvester McCoy walking away from the exploding tent in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy. He doesn't run, he doesn't reach out with his hand, he walks. And he doesn't flinch. And he didn't flinch either, did he, when they recorded that?
It was really close to him.
What a star. What a guy.
Yeah.
That's
a great image. So there's a question from Didymus Holmes on Twitter, and he asks if you carried on watching the show after you left, but what would you have done differently for a promo during Jody's era, because there was talk that there wasn't a brand manager in that time, and you know, things were you know, markedly different in the sort of promo and stuff, and I think there was difficulties really getting things done because of the changes behind the scenes and stuff like that, with, you know, the BBC studios and things like that. I don't mean the, you know, Chris coming on and stuff like that.
Yeah. My answer is I'm not going to answer that. That's really unfair. partly because I wasn't really sort of interacting with it, so I kind of don't know. Also, that would be a really unfair thing to do. Like, if I go back to the analogy of it, like splitting up with a partner, it's a bit like giving notes on their new boyfriend and what I think they should do.
Yes, so
I would never do that.
Yeah. Fair enough. That's,
well done for us.
That's all right, yeah.
Ian Banks, who's also on Twitter, he said, how did the focus of the marketing change over your time with the show, and did the advent of social media affect the way things were done and how publicity was handled?
Oh, gosh, that's such a broad question. I don't know if I can give a particular answer. I think something that isn't often talked about is is how the audience changed, partly because of the way the show matured when Matt became the Doctor, and how it then had a success in America and with Torchwood. So when, you know, those early David Tennant and even Christopher Eccleston periods, there was definitely, it wasn't the only target, but there was a definite aim for preteens. And then teens suddenly became interested in Doctor Who. They weren't in 2007. It was incredibly uncool. We would do visits to schools and teenagers would roll their eyes when they'd see the TARDIS and Daleks there. It was only like 8-year-olds would be excited about it. But then, and this isn't something just unique to Doctor Who, I think there was a rise of the geek in a way that had been really uncool when we were young. And suddenly, and even now, it's to be a geek and to be a, whatever it is, a Marvel Comics fan or a Harry Potter fan or whatever it is you might be a fan of, is kind of cool and almost sexy in some ways.
Mm. Yeah, you don't need to be embarrassed about it anymore.
Exactly. And so that sort of changed. You know, that's certainly something that happened there. I mean, social media has changed everything. So it's a silly, almost a moot point. you know, you make an announcement, you put it on social media because it then goes to everybody in a way that, you know, you just couldn't reach people before. So obviously that had an effect, positive and negative. You know, I don't think, I can't speak for now, but I would be very surprised if people are watching what's being said on Twitter and then feeding back, because we never did. I mean, people were vaguely aware of it. I might have looked because I had a Twitter presence, but lots of people didn't. But if everyone thinks like they're going, oh yes, they didn't really like the Goblin song in the Christmas Day episode, so let's not do that again. That I would be very surprised if that happens. It certainly didn't happen in my time.
Yeah.
Agreed. So if you don't like the Goblin song, who cares? No one's listening.
Yeah.
And I think there's always a misunderstanding in some way that you know, social media is like a representative of the wider thing. It's, despite the numbers that are there, I think it's still a very small fraction of the whole. So I don't think you can take that as a representative sample.
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
There's a question from Doctor Who Production News on Twitter. What happened to the book that you were writing?
Yes.
It was with Obverse Books, was that right?
Yes, I was going to do a book, and then COVID happened. I was going to do a book about my time, and then COVID happened. So the book that I was going to write just wouldn't have been the same. And I did think, I did carry on for a few years thinking, should I do it, and sort of planning stuff. And it just wouldn't be the same, because at the point when I would have had to deliver, I'd really wanted to meet up with old colleagues and go, do you remember this? And what happened then? You know, when we went to Buckingham Palace, did we take the toilet paper? That kind of stuff. And it just wasn't possible. I just and for many of us, as we all know, life just went in a very different way in COVID. And it comes to a point where I was probably coming up to delivery, and I sort of gave a long thought to it and thought, no, I'm not going to do it now. But a lot of it's in my head still, and maybe one day I'll do it, or maybe it'll just come out from these kind of things.
You've shared some stories with us today, which you know, will
might sure go some way towards
fill in that gap.
Yeah,
so we've got one last question for you, which comes from our friend Fraser Gregory on Twitter, and he'd like to know, quarks or crotons?
quarks or crotons? I think quarks. I think the crotons.
The crotons. Did you hear that, Fraser? Quarks.
Yeah. The quarks are kind of cool, aren't they, with those arms and the funny heads and stuff like that. The crotons are a bit embarrassing and they're weird sound effects and accents. Although I think the crotons it's a slightly better story than the Dominators. Or we've got it in full, haven't we, the crotons, whereas we don't have... Do we have all episodes of the Dominators?
Yeah, we do. We've got all the Dominators.
It's five episodes, isn't it, whereas crotons is only four. Yeah, I go with quarks, definitely. They've got silly voices too. Yes.
I'm sure we'll
have
that in response, yeah.
I think Fraser will be very happy with that answer.
Yes, yeah. Well, Edward, it's been a real pleasure having you on our show today. Thank you for taking the time to do it and, you know, for sharing your stories and insight with us. You know, we've talked for a couple of hours here and I think we could probably have gone on for longer, but you know, I'm aware that
it's been a pleasure.
A day to get back to and stuff.
Yeah, I've not done this for a very long time, so it's been nice to talk about it. You know, they were great times. I had a really fantastic time. Yeah. You know, like any job, it gets to a Monday morning, you don't necessarily want to go into work, and you have good days and bad days, but generally my memories of it are really, really positive and very happy.
Yeah, you talk very fondly of it, which is clear. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah.
So,
definitely.
You know, as fans, thank you for, you know, everything there, you know, like I said earlier. All the things that you were involved in have, you know, entertained us all for, you know, over many years
and so, touched us in some way. So it's that connection, isn't it? We've all been
That's
part
nice
of that,
to
and
you.
you've made
That's
it happen
nice
in so
you.
Many ways.
Yeah,
great. Thank you very
and,
much.
And good luck with, you know, your script supervising and directing plans and your short film as well and everything else that you're working
thank you,
on.
Yes, well, maybe I'll get to show it at your festival.
Brilliant. Well, I was going to plug it, but I thought, I won't, so you've done it for me. and you'll know two of the judges then. So,
fantastic. Edward Russell, Brilliant. Thank you so much for
thank
joining
you very
us.
Much.
Listeners, thank you for listening and tuning in. And don't forget, there'll be more Who Corner to Corner coming your way very soon. So stay tuned. Thank you
See
for
you
listening.
Thanks
Bye
a
for
lot.
Now.